Welcome to episode 141 of the Sentientism Podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I speak with Ava Hammer. Ava is the operations lead for the startup nonprofit Pax Fauna. Pax Fauna exists to design a more effective social movement for animal freedom in the US. Ava has been organizing in the animal freedom movement since 2015 when she started working with Direct Action Everywhere in Chicago, where she focused on building community, writing protest music, and compiling the movement's songs into an online songbook used by advocates around the world. She started working full-time as DXE's legal coordinator in 2018, managing the organization's legal cases, organizing training, and orchestrating large artistic demonstrations. Building on a background in Kingian nonviolence, Ava is a dedicated student of nonviolent communication. She's committed to bringing NVC's repertoire of creative problem-solving tools to the work of building a better culture in the animal movement. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 140 others. Don't forget to work through that back catalogue if you've just found us. Hopefully those conversations are pretty timeless. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend helps us nudge more people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates, or just search for Sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made very welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Ava. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join this series of Sentientist conversations. It's great to have the chance to have a proper conversation after a few online messages. And it's an honor to have you as a listener of the podcast too. So it's great to bring you on as a guest. And we were introduced by another previous guest, Lucas Spiegel, who I had the honor of speaking to a while back. So it's great to bring you on. So as you know, this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the most important and deepest philosophical questions. What's real? How should we understand the universe best? But just as important, who matters in our ethical system? And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to develop this really pluralistic, broad worldview called sentientism, which suggests that we should take a naturalistic approach to understanding the universe when we're thinking about what's real and what and how to believe, using evidence and reason. And that when it comes to the question of moral scope and ethics, that every sentient being should matter to us. We should have compassion for every being that can experience suffering or flourishing. I can see one even in the bush behind you. You've got some avian friends behind you in the coffee shop. But I'm talking in these conversations to people who both agree and disagree with that way of thinking. So it'll be fascinating to understand your philosophical story and how that plays through into your work. But before we get onto those big questions, how would you best introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Ava Hamer. I am operations lead at Pax Fauna. Pax Fauna is a kind of startup nonprofit. We're a new research organization in the animal freedom space. And we exist to kind of front load a new social movement organization in the US. So our mission is that we exist to design a more effective social movement for animal freedom in the US using original research as well as a careful study of social movement literature and the recent history of the animal movement. And we're really focused on reversing the cultural norm of eating animals. So yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It's I love the framing of sentientism, the framing of kind of widening our moral scope and really kind of the frank conversations about who matters. It feels really important to me. And I appreciate getting to be here.
Brilliant. Thank you. And given your work with Pax Fauna, I'm expecting you to have the perfect answer to the question, how can we make a better future when we get to that at the back end of the conversation. It's a tough one. Yeah, let's go. Okay, so let's start with the first of those really deep questions. What's real? So for many of my guests, that's often a story of how they grew up originally, whether that was more in a sort of naturalistic, maybe scientific-minded, maybe atheist or agnostic family or social context, or one that was more religious or mystical or supernatural in some way, and how that side of their thinking has changed over time about, you know, what reality is and how we should best understand it. So you can wind the clock back as far as you're comfortable telling that story.
Sure. Well, growing up, I definitely loved the supernatural. I really loved thinking of ghosts and you know, I kind of put God in that category and mystical things. I was raised Episcopalian, which we thought of as a, or I think of as a really, at least my experience of it was a very mild kind of form of Christianity. We had all the rituals of basically Catholicism. I was baptized, went to church, communion. And I remember really enjoying that. I remember really having a lot of needs met by going to church as a kid. And I even kind of went towards the experience of confirmation, the kind of like rite of passage that you get as a young teen, I think. And at around that same time, I started feeling a little bit skeptical of religion, started feeling a little bit curious about how we came to be in this faith, how different faiths operate. Maybe I kind of wanted to find a different one that felt more resonant with me. And I spent a lot of time online at that point. It was like fifth grade, I think, that I was really interested in debating people online about religion. It was kind of my biggest hobby at the time.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, so it was around the same time I was getting kind of more involved with the church that I was also having this parallel track of getting a lot more skeptical about religion in general, about all these different faiths that I was being exposed to. And I remember a particular moment that I was reading about something, maybe some paganism or something. And I had a sort of sudden realization that, like, oh, I don't actually believe all of this. This is really like, there's a lot of very interesting ideas out there. And I was definitely looking for some kind of moral resonance, some kind of like something about purpose and something about having kind of a unifying force for your whole life. There's definitely needs met.
What does it all mean? What's it all for? Mm-hmm. That type of, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And still, I remember a particular moment that I just kind of distanced from the whole thing. And I think from there, I had some years, quite a few years that I really identified as an atheist. That like atheism was important to me because I was really focused on kind of the harms of religion and the something that felt really illogical about something that I was able to be a little bit like, scoffing at religion to some extent. Yeah. Since then, I still don't have a relationship to supernatural. I still don't believe in anything kind of that can't be falsified. And I'm really connected to the needs that can be met by religion for many people. I worked in hospice for about, I think, 4.5 years or so, with people at the end of their lives. And I had to get very comfortable with religion at that period of time. And I even, for a point that I took part in a Ash Wednesday ritual, the whole cross on the forehead and everything. And yeah, I guess I cite that to sort of illustrate this direction of from a point that I wouldn't maybe take part in a prayer or like, hold hands around a table if there was some kind of group religious experience going on, to something that feels a lot less allergic to religion, a lot like a lot of appreciation for the needs that are met by like through community and through purpose and through having some kind of unifying moral force to or moral principles to kind of guide one's life. I think this is all really important, and it's not really the way that I see the world. When I think about my own spirituality, I can kind of characterize it by nonviolence throughout my activism. I've studied nonviolence first from a Kingian perspective, and then to the teachings of Dr. King. And more recently, I've gotten more involved in nonviolent communication. And both are really based on some ideas that feel like they meet the needs of religion. That,
yeah.
Have a community, have a unifying kind of moral theory that sort of can unite both like the purpose of being here and also kind of the way that we go about making moral decisions in our lives without kind of the supernatural, without the extra things that I find often pretty harmful.
Yeah, thank you. And as you started to, I guess, challenge the Episcopalian religion and I guess challenge other religions as well, what was the friction? Why were you questioning? Was it a question of sort of the story doesn't stack up and it's facts and evidence and reason, it just doesn't feel true? Or was it because you saw some ethical issues in some of those worldviews you were pushing against, or a bit of both?
I imagine that the first step towards it was curiosity, was
yeah,
really a step towards the supernatural, was wanting to experience something that felt really magical and meaningful. And I think from there I was exposed to some of the more harmful sides of Christianity, some of the more hostile or unaccepting or destructive sides that maybe would have people kind of regret themselves or feel rejected from their families or communities in ways that didn't feel moral to me. And I think that I first wanted to push back against that kind of in this protective way that, like, raised with a very like liberal ideology that really valued acceptance and really valued care for others. And seeing those particular sides of Christianity in particular and some other religions, that sort of, I think, was the fire behind it, was the fire behind that kind of like real hostility towards religion that I held.
Yeah.
And in the kind of, you know, search to find something else, I think just the variety of ideas and kind of really strong beliefs about the world and about the universe that we find kind of made some cracks in this kind of idea that a supernatural worldview is.
Yeah, thank you. And it's an interesting journey that's a parallels with mine, because I grew up in quite you know, moderate, gentle background, quiet version of Christianity. It wasn't very in your face. It was just a sort of community and cultural and social default that didn't really drive our lives. It still took me quite a while to come to terms with moving away from it, even though it wasn't a sort of high control type religious environment at all. But I guess there is that sense of you know, doubling down on atheism because you feel a little bit either, you know, betrayed, or you found something that seems more solid, and you know, feel like you can look with clear eyes at what you've left, and that can be quite judgmental. But that can often be twinned at the same time with this sort of sense that you have still lost something, in that, you know, you had this ethical structure, there was the community, there was a sense of purpose, and now you've challenged that and seen it was poorly founded. So there can be this sort of, okay, you know, where do I go now? Where is the meaning? And, you know, there is that sort of classic teenage thing of going through a nihilist phase where, okay, well, then nothing matters. But I like the way you describe the fact that you've, you know, through Kingian thought and nonviolent communication and, you know, those ethical structures have, in a sense, rebuilt that sense of purpose and meaning in a, you know, in a naturalistic context that doesn't need the baggage of the supernatural. But yeah, so it's a fascinating journey. Thank you.
Another piece that maybe I skipped is a lot of you mentioned what was missing, what was maybe missing, and I definitely resonate with that a lot. There's kind of a piece that meets a lot of needs for religion that I think I went to towards through like meditation, at first through getting very involved in yoga and like a very religious sect of yoga that also kind of had a lot of this supernatural at the time, kind of with the atheist identity. I felt like a lot of, like, in a way that was more difficult to reconcile, more difficult to kind of get the things that did work for me out of meditation, out of the practice, out of the philosophy, with the supernatural attached. Since then, I think I've found a much more kind of secular form of meditation, a way that I can get in touch with the important things about it and the things that are really really useful, even using supernaturalism as a metaphor sometimes, I think is something that I've gotten a lot more comfortable with, even though it's not definitely part of the worldview of the beliefs.
Yeah, thank you. And you can also see that in the way that people use terms like spirituality, and as you did earlier on, right? For some people that is explicitly a supernatural thing. You know, they believe that spirits exist or there's some supernatural force. But I think many people, I think as you do, are still comfortable using the term spirituality as a sense of connectedness and the importance of the world we're surrounded by, and a feeling of affinity, and, you know, that can feel quite spiritual as well, in a sense, even if it's completely naturalistically grounded. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely a sense of, I would probably call it a sense of felt sense of purpose, or a felt sense of wholeness. I guess by itself, I probably wouldn't jump to the word spirituality, or definitely an identity around spirituality.
But there's a commonality there, I guess, isn't there? Yeah, in that feeling, in that sense. Yeah, regardless of what the underpinnings are, in a way. Yeah, thank you. So we've answered what's real, or at least, you know, how to go about choosing what to believe, because as you were talking about, you know, an idea needs to be falsifiable. And I guess the flip side of that is that you want things to be supported by evidence and reasoning. And of course, that doesn't guarantee we're going to be right, but it seems like the most sensible way to me of understanding the world is to engage with it honestly and use whatever faculties we've got. So I think that ties that quite neatly. And we've already started to talk about the second really big question about what matters, because one of the challenges of people who have moved away from a religious worldview is that religious worldview came with a bunch of facts about things you're supposed to believe, whether it's heaven and hell and gods and certain other things going on. But it also came with a bunch of, you know, ethical and moral stuff too, commandments, the Quran, you know, holy books, the hadiths, whatever it might be. So for some people, when they move away from a religious worldview, that's something else that needs to be rebuilt as well. So I tend to ask this question, sometimes the what matters question, you know, what's the granny of ethics? And then we'll come on to the who matters question first. But if I was to ask you that, you know, what matters, how has your thinking about that changed over time as you started out with an Episcopalian worldview and then moved away from that? What do right and wrong and good and bad even mean to you in the most basic terms?
Sure. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of different ways that question was answered over the years in a way that has really just been simplified. It's I think nonviolence makes it quite simple, or at least in my mind right now, the questions are quite simple, where maybe religion, both the experience of Episcopalianism and of yoga had rules or principles or very many of them anyway, different ways that we think about judging right and wrong. And these days, through nonviolence, it's try to get away from thinking in right and wrong, thinking instead in needs, with the guiding principle that everyone's needs matter. You can definitely think about some needs mattering more than others, some needs being bigger than others or more urgent than others, and really wanting to have a worldview where I'm at least seeking to understand that every single thing that a person does is some attempt to meet a need. What this does for me is gets me out of the kind of black and white thinking that right and wrong and good and bad can kind of put us in, and into something that is a little bit lighter and a little bit more able to be creative around some of the problem solving that we need to do in social movements and in the world. So thinking about a really radical belief as kind of a basis of what everyone else, that everything a person does, some attempt to meet a need. And that's not something that we use to justify action for the really harmful, but something that we use to try to understand, and only kind of with this idea that only from understanding what could be going on and that that's a real person, that's a real need that's trying to be met, at least by an action that could be really violent, could be really harmful, something we really don't like, that if there's some way to understand it, then maybe there's something to help, maybe there's some way to reach a resolution with people committing harm.
Yeah. So there's a focus on interests, which by definition means you're taking into account and you're caring about the perspective of others, and you're twinning that with a genuine attempt to understand as far as we can from their perspective, you know, what those interests are and what they're underpinned by and what they need, and then that gives you that sense of flexibility in negotiation and open-mindedness that, you know, is maybe a bit different from, as you said, some more sort of black and white, maybe rule-based systems. Yeah, thank you.
The perspective, trying to understand the perspective, very important tonight. I think trying to find the need itself, there's sometimes a way that when the need can kind of be divorced from the story or the perspective or the you know, way that we go about meeting the need, especially thinking in terms of some strategies like violence that really don't work for us. Sometimes being able to think of another way to meet that need can be super healing, can be a way that those creative solutions can come about.
Yeah.
It seems like important ideas for the kind of philosophy of nonviolence.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess there's no easy way of answering this, but you know, we can go a long way just by recognizing and respecting and trying to help meet the interests of others. There are so many things we could do that would in itself be enough progress, but there are many areas where interests conflict, of course, and those can be benign in a sense, and that, you know, you might just have to take difficult choices between two different sets of interests, and sometimes they can be, you know, viciously opposed, in that some people will have what they call our interests that directly involve, for example, needlessly harming or even killing others as well. And I guess that's one concern people have about ideas of nonviolence is that I think people will say nonviolence is great, but when you're in a situation where you're faced by someone who is violent, is your own violent response sometimes the compassionate thing to do to protect others, for example? So when you get into some of those tougher questions, is there something you can say there about how you think about resolving those really brutal trade-offs when there's a direct conflict of interest, or where the interest is something that is going to directly harm others?
Yeah, absolutely. So we think about differentiating between like needs and strategies. So a need is this kind of universal concept that everybody needs care and shelter and love and water and safety. And we have a lot of different strategies to get to those needs. And some of those are violent. Some of those are ones that we really don't like. We really want to not have. I guess when I think of someone doing something violent to meet, I want to think about them doing something that they're really trying to meet a need that I want met for them. So thinking of eating animals is kind of a simple one. We think about pleasure, taste, think about convenience and ease, thinking about all the cultural needs, all the community and kind of even purpose and connection to family and ancestors. Those are all things that I want met for people who would be eating animals. They're all needs that like I care for.
Yeah.
And obviously the need to for safety for an animal is greater than that. Not that the animal's needs in general matter more, but that the particular need is a bigger one.
Because it's more fundamental and, or?
Yeah, it's more fundamental. It's you know, without safety, we can't get all the other needs met. Without being alive, we can't have all the other needs met. And of course, separately, I really think that suffering is something that deserves a special kind of consideration. That preventing suffering is like a really kind of intuitively important idea. So,
yeah. And there's lots of different frameworks that I find quite interesting that think about that sort of hierarchy of needs or interests. You know, there's the classic Maslow's hierarchy. And then I know Scott Barry Kaufman has done a version that he talks about a sailboat. So the boat itself is the basics you need to, you know, stay afloat and survive. And then the sailboat is the sort of more self-actualizing, you know, the other stuff. So but however you do it, and many of those models are disputed and there's, you know, some questionable evidence behind them. But I think it's still useful to be able to think about, you know, what are the most fundamental, what are the most important as you're thinking about those trade-offs. Yeah, thank you.
Sorry,
I interrupted you. Yeah.
Oh, no worries. So yeah, thinking about needs, I want to treat with care the needs that would be met by doing it. And I don't want to ever say that those needs don't matter. Clearly they do matter to people a lot because they're willing to do really heinous things or support really heinous systems to get them met. I want to be really curious about other ways to get those needs met. And when a particular need can't get met, to treat it with mourning, to not treat it with, tough luck, like not that like taste isn't that important, convenience isn't that important, like what matters really is, like I want to have care for the needs that I'm asking to get met in a particular strategy. So we usually say that needs themselves don't conflict. It's the strategies that we use to meet them that can conflict. And so there's this real emphasis in creativity that maybe you can't immediately see what the solution would be that would allow everyone's needs to get met in a particular scenario. And there's kind of maybe some element of, you could call it faith, that there's a way, that there's a third way behind like being passive and saying my needs aren't going to get met, that's fine, and being violent and saying like your needs don't matter, but there's some way that's maybe we're not seeing in any particular scenario that could allow all of us to get our needs met. So fundamental kind of nonviolence. And then another thing you alluded to is what we call like the protective use of force, the idea that sometimes in order to prevent immediate violence, of course there's a justifiable way to use force or even morally necessary way to use force. My nonviolence is definitely not pacifism. It's definitely not about like not getting my hands dirty, but it's about intervening to really prevent violence when it's happening. I think that is like a moral responsibility to find ways to do that. And yeah, so it's definitely a spectrum, and it's really, I think that piece of warning is also really important.
Yeah.
There, that if harm has to be done, it's it's we're not excited about it. We're not you know, looking for ways to get into a fight or looking for moments that where force would be justified, but really having faith in that third way and using protective force when it's possible. So when it's absolutely necessary. You know, we think about that with animals often we're doing our very best and using force in a protective way to keep animals from being hurt or from hurting others. And it's, you know, something I mourn. Like, I don't want to have to keep cats inside or keep dogs on leashes. And sometimes that's kind of the way that we have to be in the world to prevent greater harm.
Yeah.
And it's done with mourning. You know, it's not we're not excited about it.
Yeah, thank you. And I think, and I guess one way I'd put that is, and I think this is really difficult, a lot of people like the idea of a sort of universal compassion, whether it's all humans or all sentient beings. But I think one of the groups it's hardest to be compassionate for is the perpetrators of harm. Because sometimes it feels that by perpetrating the harm, they've lost their right to be morally considered. They've lost the right to compassion. And I can feel the pull of that, the sort of retributive pull of that. But I don't think it takes you to a good place. So in the same way as you were talking about, you know, it might be justified to use force to protect others or in certain circumstances, but you'd mourn the need to do that. I think that's partly, and I'd describe that as being because we still have compassion and we still have moral consideration even for the perpetrators of harm. And so there is some regret in it might be the right thing to do to use force or to deter or constrain them in some way, because we have a justification for doing so, but it's not done with enthusiasm or pleasure or joy. It's a shame because we know we are causing harm and we know we're in the way of their interest. And would you, in that context, do you see all interests as valid in some sense, or are there some types of interests that you would say, look, that's not on the hierarchy at all, right? That's an interest you shouldn't have, i.e. if someone has an interest in, you know, domineering others or oppressing others or enjoys causing harm, do you count that as an interest, recognize it's valid, think creatively about other ways it could be met that don't cause harm? Or do you say, you know, they're not even on the list, right? These aren't even valid interests. What's the approach?
It's so interesting to catch myself using the word spirituality again, because this also sort of feels like a spiritual pursuit. That yes, I really want to believe that every single action a person does an attempt to meet a need. And if the need feels like one that maybe isn't on the hierarchy, I want to dig a little deeper and see what the need is. And I think that it is a valid need to like want some control over one's environment. Like we all do want to have some control. I think that has to do with like autonomy and has to do with like being seen and making a mark on the world. And sometimes it can feel like that need is just so great in some people that it can't be met in a healthy way. And there's, you know, question about creativity there. Like, is there maybe a way that could be a change? That could, strategy could be changed to make it able to be met in a healthy way. And so there's again, like maybe some faith in that question that I really want to believe that there is a valid need there. It's a need that I have too. And there's a way to meet it that will kind of also be respectful of others' needs. And yeah, punishment can feel so good to kind of think of an enemy and think of someone who like doesn't deserve compassion anymore, and someone who doesn't deserves to be punished or harmed in some way. And that too is something I really sort of, not that I never indulge in it, but something that I really want to move away from kind of my practice of nonviolence, is really seeing every single person, especially perpetrators, I think are going to be the hardest to feel that compassion towards. But yeah, I really have a pathway towards seeing people with totally valid needs who are as needs that are as important as anyone.
Thank you. So instead of the sort of classical, this individual is doing something harmful, I will categorize them as evil, I will discount them from moral consideration and compassion, and I will revel in a retributive punishment which they deserve, your compassion is leading you to scratch under the surface of what might seem like a intrinsically harmful interest and go, well, what is it that's leading them to do this? Is it a need to be seen? Is it a need to have control? Is it, you know, is there something else underneath that that we might still ultimately be able to empathize with and maybe even help them with? So Yeah, thank you. That's a deeply compassionate aspiration, not an easy one, but.
And you know, there's a strategic piece under the kind of spiritual framing that I'm putting out there, which is I don't believe that separating ourselves is going to help us. Like, I don't believe that people sort of heal through punishment or are less likely to kind of cause more harm in the world if they're separated and they're othered and they're, you know, treated as evil. I think a lot of what happens in kind of a punitive mindset is usually destructive to the entire world. And by treating everyone with compassion, we're creating a world even for, you know, the innocent, as if any of us are innocent, that is safer and kinder.
Yeah. And I think in a similar way, right, there's a sort of ethical rationale for behaving in that way and trying to extend our compassion even to those who do harm. But I agree. I think there's also an effectiveness story there as well, in that ultimately, and I think there's decent research to back this up, that you can still have a robust justice system grounded purely in protection, deterrence, rehabilitation, restoration. You know, what I see of as the drivers of justice that are just trying to make a better world in the future. And that might involve harming and constraining. You know, it doesn't mean it's a weak or appeasing or pacifist. It can, you know, you can, those justifications can still drive some pretty strong constraint of others. But we've stripped out the pure retribution, which to my mind, the only thing retribution does is cause more harm. So yeah, I agree. There's a sort of an ethical story there, but it fortunately, I think, ties up with a effectiveness story about trying to prevent harm in the future and find better ways to live together and not have to separate each other off. Yeah, thank you. Now, the second big question in this ethical story, because I think there are many people who would agree with the way you've laid out that ethical aspiration, you know, respecting other people's interests and using nonviolent communication and creative thinking to try and find better ways of collaborating and working together. But their story would stop with humanity. So the second big question is, who matters? You know, what's the scope of our moral consideration and who warrants our compassion? So I'd be fascinated to know how your story is developed there, you know, from as a child, I guess we sort of instinctively care about our immediate family, but then that broadens out in various ways to ideally span all of humanity. But then there's that critical breakpoint about how did you come to think seriously about the ethics of non-human animals too? So again, it's a story you can tell as much or little of as you're comfortable. But
sure. Yeah, so with animals, I remember my sister being vegetarian throughout, like on and off throughout my childhood. She was 6 years older than me, looked up to her in a lot of ways. Our understanding of vegetarianism at the time excluded fishes. Maybe we didn't think fishes suffered the way other animals do or something like this, but it was very clear that, you know, when I was first kind of also going on and off in vegetarianism throughout as a kid, that was a line that got drawn. I later went vegan when I was 13, kind of as an experiment, I guess. I've always really valued discipline and really wanted to be able to demonstrate discipline. Maybe wanted to know in myself that I could, you know, really buckle down and achieve things. And this is kind of one way to sort of flex that muscle. I wanted to go 30 days without eating any animal products at all. And I thought that was going to be a huge feat that I would kind of be able to cite for the rest of my life. So,
just test yourself.
Right. Just test myself. And so it was an interesting order that it happened in, that I did all the research and I learned, you know, well, all the ingredients that a person would avoid to really be vegan. And so I got ready to do it. And I did it on first day of eighth grade, started doing the vegan thing. And the kids at school would ask about why. And really had, you know, no answer. Just wanted to see if I can do it. It was their kind of displeasure that got me to actually go do more research, right? So they like, but why would a person do that? Oh, I actually don't know. Let me go do some reading. Very quickly felt a lot of horror with what I was reading, you know, about baby chicks and baby cows and having this whole kind of awareness of the vastness of the industry and how it's really not just the killing that had disgusted me when I was not eating land animals, but whole life and the whole experience that so many animals have. I remember feeling really a lot of dread about that. I think I experienced probably the same kind of knee jerk that a lot of people do. In Taxbana, we did a whole research study. We talked to about 200 regular meat eaters, American meat eaters, and so many of them really articulated that, like, it makes me feel bad and I try not to think about it, talking about animals used for food. And I think I really experienced like that same knee jerk, don't want to engage with this anymore. But since I was already doing the vegan diet, the way to not think about it was to keep eating vegan. So it was a while before I really engaged with it much further. Go ahead.
So it sounds like your sister's vegetarianism and yours was driven from an ethical stance. It was the not wanting to kill and I guess not wanting to consume flesh as a result. So there was an ethical trigger there. And the step to veganism was a bit more of a sort of personal challenge and a, you know, psychological thing. But do you think that you pushed back less hard on the things you were finding out because you'd already stepped out of consuming animal products? Did that make it sort of easier? Because I get the sense that one of the recurring themes in these conversations is that people emotionally and intellectually find it hard to criticize a system that they're complicit in. But once they've stepped out of that system, whether it's for ethics or climate or health or personal challenge, it sort of becomes easier to get your head around it because you don't have that drive to deny and to ignore.
Absolutely, yeah, a bit more spaciousness for sure. That I didn't need to say I'm never going to think about this again, and I'm, because my very next meal depends on it. I think that already kind of having the relationship to the vegan diet at least was something that, yeah, a lot more spaciousness around being able to sometimes think about it or criticize it or have like a stance around it. I also think that my family had a particular relationship with animals that maybe is unusual, particularly thinking about pet rats that I had as a kid, around fifth grade, maybe sixth grade, I had some pet rats. And as rats do, they, once they're not very old at all, they start getting cancer. They got big tumors. And my mom there was absolutely no question that we were taking them to the vet, that we were getting them surgery, that I think one of them maybe had multiple surgeries to take out tumors. I think a lot of people, it wasn't really until, I got very involved in activism that it was kind of pointed out to me that, oh no, most people wouldn't do that for a rat. That rats are thought of as not real family members. Actually kind of part of our scope of who we're willing to really, really care for in that way. So I definitely have a lot of gratitude to my mom for that. She really, really deeply cared about the animals in our lives, at least the live animals. And there was just never a question that like they were going to get the care that they needed and that they were going to get considered. So thinking of, the cats that just kind of moved into our house as cats do, very much just became part of the family. And I'm sure that kind of had some relationship to how I think about animals today, that the kind of, of coarseness, the intuitiveness to including animals in the moral scope.
Yeah, just you can. I've talked before about you can, look at the science of evolutionary parallels and information processing architectures and biological neurology and behavior and communications and infer, sentience from those things. Or you can just spend quality time with a non-human animal and it's pretty obvious, right? And do you think that family context made your switch to veganism easier? Because for some people, it's really interesting in these conversations because they can feel sometimes like a parallel between moving away from a religious worldview and becoming vegan. There's a sort of intellectual challenge. There's an emotional challenge. There's a social challenge. There's a, problems with family and friends of varying degrees as well. But was that vegan switch a challenge for you? Or was that eased again, partly because, your family already took non-human animals quite seriously?
That's an interesting question. I think that I'm still not sure I understand my mom's worldview on all of this. But the thing that made it easier for me than for other people is that I was the youngest kid and my other two siblings were already moved out. So it was just me and my mom. So it was kind of, there wasn't sort of a whole family institution to challenge. It was just kind of just the two of us. And so she, to her credit, she really adjusted. She, you know, learned a couple vegan dishes that we ate, and she was annoyed. It was an inconvenience for sure. She didn't like it, but she really worked with it and you know, continues to. I took the Liberation Pledge in 2015, and I made kind of a demand of my family that I wouldn't be sitting and eating when people were eating animal products. To this day, they accommodate that, and I can tell that it's for them. It's a big accommodation. It's not nothing. It's not easy.
Yeah.
And you know, I try to accept it as a sign of care. That's being done for me. Even if, of course, I wish that the worldview was more similar, that their scopes, their moral scopes also included animals in a way that might be, but
it's difficult, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you can see why, you know, you making that pledge and then, you know, essentially holding them to it as a condition of you being together around the table, you know, is a big step, and it's something serious they're doing as a part of your relationship with them as well. So it seems like quite a big thing. But at the same time, it really shouldn't be, right? That just should be the standard default. And I had a, you know, interesting experience because I guess I came to this story reasonably late. So, I've, you know, my friend group, I've been vegetarian for like 25 years, but I've been vegan for maybe 5 or 6. And my friend group basically predate that. And there's varying degrees of, you know, sympathy with it and understanding. And but I think most of them really think of it as it's like a sort of weird hobby that I choose to participate in that they're not that interested in. That I don't think they really get how central it is to my view of the world, you know, and they certainly wouldn't treat my stance on any intrahuman ethical topic in that way, right? They'd, if we're talking about racism or homophobia or sexism or transphobia or something else, they'd immediately get that was absolutely central and sort of non-negotiable and something we would all agree with. Whereas with this, it's like an optional extra. So I was around one of these friends recently, and it was very really sweet because their daughter had actually made a separate vegan dessert just for me, and quite a few people tried it, and the consensus was it was just as good, if not better, than the other one. And that's the question: like, why did you make the other one? Right? Why did you make it? Anyway? So it's strange because on the one hand, it seems like a really big step for people to make this concession to us, but on the other hand, it's the minimum we should be asking, really. It's just this strange conflict we find ourselves in at this stage in human history, I guess. So, but that's just me ranting and venting rather than making a point. But yeah, thank you. And so that's really interesting how you went through that story. When you think about how you set your moral scope now, how do you think of the term animal as being how you set that scope? Do you think of the concept of sentience as important? Do you think about, you know, even going beyond sentient beings? You know, there are biocentrists and ecocentrists who will talk about the rights of nature or the rights of plants. Or I should ask a clearer question. How do you set your moral scope now? How far does your compassion extend?
Well, I think of sentience, you know, who can suffer? It matters, like suffering matters to me. And I think of sentience is the measure of who's suffering and who's not suffering. There are definitely some individuals who I have no doubt suffer, you know, unless the world is a hallucination and I'm the only one who experiences anything, then they're, you know, animals suffer. I feel less sure about certain creatures. I feel, you know, uncertain, and kind of to the degree that the uncertainty exists, I think it's good to err on the side of figuring that they can probably suffer. And I have, you know, I have curiosity about if suffering can kind of exist in ways that we don't understand. I don't kind of scoff at the idea that there could be sentience in some plants or in some someday some machines. And to the extent that like that exists or can exist, it matters. And there's the degree of certainty that certain individuals suffer feels really important. it feels completely undebatable that the pigs and cows and chickens and fishes all suffer really, really greatly. And their suffering should definitely be part of our moral, yeah, moral scope. I feel relatively certain that insect suffering matters, and the scale of it is mind-boggling, right, to think about,
yeah,
that problem. Similarly, like animals in the wild, it's just, the scope of it is mind-boggling and so difficult to think about what solutions would look like,
yeah,
to that degree of suffering. And there's no doubt in my mind that it matters whether or not the problems are solvable. They are individuals who suffer in that kind of way. And so systems, yeah, to the extent that they contain individuals, ecosystems, and or that they support individuals, rivers, they matter.
Yep.
And I don't sort of, I could imagine, you know, personhood for rivers and forests being a useful legal concept, perhaps, and morally does make sense to me that they matter in that they are homes for individuals who matter.
Thank you. I think we're going to struggle to disagree on this one because, I'm completely with you. I think the fact that sentience might have, you know, fuzzy boundaries that we don't know where they are, the fact that it may not always be perfectly possible to assess the degree of sentience of an entity, I think none of that undermines the moral salience of the capacity to suffer. So I love the way you put that, right? Wherever it is, whatever it is, it matters almost definitionally. And I think it probably ties back to your focus on interests before, because to my mind, for an entity to have interests, it needs to be sentient by definition. It needs to have the capacity to have, you know, valenced experiences, you know, good thing, feel good things or bad things, you know, where that's the root of the interests. And I think when people talk about, you know, the interests of a river, or again, I'm open-minded about plants, but at the moment I'm pretty confident they're not sentient. But, you know, they talk about the interests of a river or a plant or an ecosystem. To my mind, those interests are in the person's head. They're not a characteristic of the entity themselves. Whereas when I care about your interests, it's because you have those interests and you care, mm-hmm, directly. And morality is my choice to care about your interests. So I think we'll probably end up in a similar place there. And I'd agree, right? You granting rights to a river or protections to ecosystems may well make sense legally and practically, but the reason we're doing that morally is because of the impact of those systems and those concepts and those structures on the sentient beings. Ultimately, they're the ones that really matter. And that's why we care about our ecosystem more than the ecosystem on Venus, because our ecosystem directly impacts sentient beings. Whereas if you genuinely were ecocentric and you cared about any ecosystem anywhere, you'd be just as concerned about, you know, other barren planets with no life on them and no sentient beings as you would about our own, which I think gives it the lie. So, yeah, so I think we'll probably agree on that focusing on sentience and interests as a place to bound our moral scope. And one of the other things I've been banging on about recently that I see as a worry, right? So if you and I share this sort of sentiocentric moral concern, and we see, as you mentioned, you know, the problems of wild animal suffering, however tough it might be to address, as a serious one, and we look at farmed animal suffering as an egregious and actually easily fixable problem because we just need to stop and consume plants instead. There are a few ways people can resist that. And we're used to all the cognitive dissonance and the denial and the acrasia and the ignorance and the whatever else, right, that goes on. But technically, it seems to me, one, you can either deny the sentience of these beings and say, look, animals don't suffer. You know, there's a long history of going back to Descartes of people saying that only humans actually have the capacity to suffer. And shockingly, there are people today who actually think that unless you have the capacity for language, for some reason that disqualifies you from moral consideration because you physically cannot suffer. So torturing the puppy at my feet here would be morally completely neutral because that being cannot suffer. I'm like, so that's weird, but people do it, right? They deny the suffering. The other thing you can do is deny that the harm is being done. So you can say, you know, farming doesn't harm animals, or, you know, it's better for them to exist than not have existed, to the extent that, you know, it's a, you know, the harm is not being done. And of course, when you look at the facts of how animal agriculture works, they directly contravene that story, right? The harm is clear and obvious and direct and egregious. But there's also another theme here, which is that, and I had a very frustrating as many conversations on Twitter are, conversation recently with someone who said, look, I'm a sentientist, but I support animal agriculture. And their argument was, I'm a sentientist, I have moral consideration for all sentient beings, but I think my interests in enjoying the taste of their flesh is so much more important than them. Even though I have moral consideration for them, I still think it's good to farm. So what that seemed to be doing to me was be taking the ideas of compassion and moral consideration and moral status, and we're very familiar with people doing this already with the ideas of, you know, animal welfare and the term humane, and essentially destroying their definitions. Because if you can claim, if I was to say to you, you know, I have compassion for you, I have moral consideration for you, I grant you rights, I care about your welfare, I want to treat you in a humane way, but I'm going to farm you so I can eat bits of your body, you'd probably turn around to me and say, Jamie, you know, that isn't the sort of compassion that has any value to me, right? You've destroyed the definition of those words. So it seems to me that there's a theme there where, yeah, I don't really know where I'm going with this, but it seems to me it's not enough just to get people to conceptually say, yes, I care about other animals. We've got to get them to recognize that caring, even minimally, involves not needlessly causing suffering and death, and then put that into practice. It's almost like there's another level of challenge, right?
It's so interesting to kind of hear it spelled out, right? How people kind of make these things connect in their mind. And I think that as bizarre as it sounds, I think that's probably a fairly common worldview that, you know, we want animal welfare where it is possible, so long as it doesn't kind of inconvenience us, raise the price of our food, or mean that we're eating different things. Giving up cultural traditions or convenience or taste or what have you. And it's definitely fascinating to think about it. So when I think about this kind of like really sort of motivated reasoning that happens with like, okay, well, I can be good to animals and also say that it don't really matter as much as me. I think about just the real need for kind of cultural change. What we really think about at Texfauna is how do we tell a story that the world is moving away from using animals? However that shift happens, I really want people to be thinking that the future is one where we're moving away from using animals for food.
It's happening. It's just happening. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that can kind of help to just have some kind of conception in the minds of people that it's that this is where we're going, that this isn't weird, that I don't need to kind of be doing these mental gymnastics to explain why things are the way that they are, because the way that they are is a shift. That of course we support because we're, you know, we're modern people who care about animals like we always do. You know, animal welfare does pretty well when it's voted on by people. People who tend to care about animals. Or when given an option between torturing them pretty bad and torturing them worse, like they really want the less torture.
And I
think it's also very much a matter of framing, that the way often we aren't really thinking about it as, or people aren't really thinking of the whole, you know, food system as kind of in one coherent way. Like we can think about individual animals as individuals, of course we don't want to hurt, while thinking about food as something kind of separate.
No, that's a really interesting way of framing it. I like that, in that you're, mm-hmm. instead of it being this endless debate over what we're doing, whether what we're doing now is right or wrong, and how we should do it slightly less egregiously, you're just trying to shift the default completely to, this is where we're going, let's focus on that. Yeah.
So, you know, we've heard, I've sort of increasingly gotten skeptical about surveys and kind of the value of surveys. I don't think people really kind of engage in surveys in the same way they engage in the real world. But that said, we've heard, you know, survey data from Sentience Institute that some third of Americans or something support a ban on slaughter. Some really, really radical things. While 98% say that eating meat is a personal choice and no one can tell me what to do. And I don't actually, like, I feel like I have an understanding of how those two things can kind of exist in the same mind. That when we're sort of in one frame, we have a completely set of different set of values and beliefs around what kind of world we want to see. And when we're in this other frame, like ourselves as consumers, as people who eat, we care a lot about personal choice and autonomy and self-expression and membership in a culture. And I'm really interested. We are really interested in figuring out how to message around animals in a way that really puts people in that first frame of thinking of themselves as a voter or a citizen, and making decisions about how they want the world to be instead of kind of just how they want to consume as a person, because those are very different parts of yourself, the consumer and the voter or the citizen. So we're really interested in figuring out policy, like messages, and also policy goals that will help tell that story that society is evolving away from I really like that metaphor of evolution. That's sort of how people talk about it when they talk about societal changes all happening together. But it's not about me going vegan or me, the individual, you know, meat eater, like changing something that I'm buying with, like, you know, whatever small amount of money I'm contributing to the economy. It's something that just breeds so much powerlessness that it's so hard to feel like you're going to make a change when, like, your dollar is kind of all you have. And instead thinking about, like, us as a society and the shift that's happening and, you know, shift that we want to see happening. The moral interest that we kind of want to move towards in the way that we've seen so many other times before. We think of evolution happening biologically and kind of morally in all sorts of different ways. So this is really kind of the puzzle that we see in front of us towards creating better.
Yeah, thank you. And I like that way of sort of picking the frame and focusing on it, because it strikes me that on the one hand, it's deeply frustrating because habits and social norms are so entrenched and very difficult to change. And that can give, you know, quite a pessimistic cast to, I guess, what we're trying to do with this sort of idea of a more universal sentiocentric compassion. It seems that we're fighting against something that's really difficult to break: social norms and, you know, industry motivations and powerful lobbyists and motivated politicians and so on. But then the frame you're focusing on is more hopeful, because it's picking up this, it's almost sort of assuming that we all want to go in this direction, because of course who wouldn't want to care about non-human sentient animals, right? Which is true, right? And that's what I find a lot of hope in, that because almost everybody cares at least to some degree about some non-human animals. They might be selective about it. It might not be enough to challenge their own personal decisions, but there is absolutely at least a kernel of ethical, you know, latent ethical agreement there with most of the human population that we can work on. So focusing on that, you know, just sort of assuming this is where we're going to go and how we're going to do it, feels much more constructive and positive to me. Now, one of the pushbacks we'll get is that some people worry that focusing too strongly on the sort of systemic stuff can then be used as an excuse by people for essentially doing nothing. So you'll see these tropes both in the climate space and in the animal space, and people saying, you know, it's all about the systems, it's the big corporations, blah, 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 you know, no ethical consumption under capitalism. And basically what that means is, great, I don't have to do anything. One, I don't have to change my personal decisions. But two, I'm not actually going to do anything to drive the systemic change either, because they're so powerful and anonymous that I can just sort of sit back and relax and use the system as an excuse. How do you, and do you think we can mitigate that sort of risk, because humans are so good at looking for excuses not to change, and the system can be another one of those?
Yeah, I mean, what I would love is a lot of opportunities to, you know, an organization providing a lot of opportunities for people to really get involved in the system changes.
Yeah.
And once you do that, you really don't want to be a hypocrite, and the kind of the personal integrity practice of veganism, which is really what it is. Like, it's not something that has a huge effect on the economy and demand for animal products, but it's, you know, for me, veganism is a way that I practice a personal integrity is something that is kind of how I signal what matters to me in the world. And it seems that with this kind of pair, with like an actual like invitation to do systemic work, because it's hard, right? It's hard to think of, like, okay, well, how do I change the system? That is another puzzle that organizations have that are seeking to mobilize people to give them actual meaningful contributions to make into the world. They're both, you know, both interested in, like, the contribution that we can make towards changing the system, but also, like, how do we really get a lot of people involved in that? Because I know for me and for a lot of people, experiences in activism are transformational. Kind of changes the whole way you think about yourself and the way that you think of what matters to you. Like, when I, you know, first saw myself get arrested, I saw, oh, I guess I'm a person who gets arrested for animal rights. It sort of allowed me to sort of change my self-conception. And I'm really interested in sort of being able to facilitate that kind of process for a lot of people on a mass scale, that seeing ourselves do work in this way, I think can sort of just bypass that whole futility question of like, well, I can't do that, can't do this. Doesn't matter if I do anything consumer, just gonna sit back.
Yeah. And it's a tangent, but as I understand it, is the court case from one of the rescues you participated in that's still live at the moment, isn't it?
Yes. Ridgeland Farms in Wisconsin. I believe that they listen to the prosecutor listens to every interview that I do. So I've got you a couple extra listeners. But that was a rescue in 2017 that we actually did, three beagles, and it's, supposed to go to trial. We have a trial date set in March. Not go through exactly then, but we're facing a couple of felonies each for participation in the rescue. And I think open rescue is really important. That too, about our transformation, the experience of, you know, I've been inside of farms that house chickens and pigs and seen some really, really horrific things. And it's this way that it can really get, there can be distance, there can be kind of be abstract, especially if, you know, we don't really watch like videos anymore. And I don't think we have to like take these high risks to have that experience. And I went to a safe vigil here in LA last night, and it's experience of actually looking individuals in the eye and like knowing that individual's world matters to them as much as mine does to me, I think is a very sobering, very, yeah. Can be very motivating.
Yeah, thank you. And so if we're thinking about this frame of ultimately trying to drive systemic change and sort of just assuming, look, we're going this way, so come with us and help. And you, as you mentioned, you're interested in messaging and policy that can shift. You've still got a very big toolkit of levers that you can choose to pull. And that can involve activism and direct action and some of the things you've just been talking about. You can talk about the role of the law, whether it's regulation or legislation changing, all the way through from conception through to enforcement. You can think about economic levers. You can think about political levers. You can think about media and the role of culture and art and music and shifting things around. So as you think about that sort of mind-bending range of sort of systemic interventions you might make, do you have a view as to which are the more impactful to pull on to try and drive change?
Sure. Well, when I think about, you know, the whole scope of interventions that we have and the whole scope of kind of levers that we want to pull, I think about the movement as an ecosystem, that there are some people who are really well positioned to lower the price of, gosh, I freeze up on this word because I don't know which one I like the best, but protein, that lower the price of nonviolent, slaughter-free meat, say.
Yeah.
And that's not me. I'm not in that space, and I'm glad that people are doing that work. And it's not, you know, not probably the best use of my space. There's also people who are well positioned to do lobbying, to make friends with legislatures or to you know, elect friendly politicians. The thing I'm really interested in is the grassroots. The grassroots space, I think, is really well positioned, much more to do cultural change work than to lobby for specific policies. Mm. And I think ballot initiatives are a really cool way to kind of just sidestep the whole mess of the way that most of the political system is working right now. And so we're really interested in launching ballot initiatives that are more radical than the movement has seen get on the ballot so far. And in that way, kind of use that as a policy ask and as something that is a signal to the world that we are looking for.
Yeah.
Because there's kind of some legitimacy that comes with like this very straight-laced, very like through the system intervention of putting something on the ballot. I'm definitely very curious.
Yeah. I mean, as an amateur, I really like the ballot initiative ideas, partly because it seems to tap into the latent ethical agreement that most humans have. So, you know, I had a previous episode with team who are running the Yes on IP initiative in Oregon. And the question is really simple. It's like, you know, sort of, you know, we have rules around animal cruelty because of course, everyone disagrees. You know, everyone thinks animal cruelty is a bad thing, right? So should we remove all the exemptions so that we protect all the animals? Simple question, right? Who could resist? Now, of course, the chances of that turning into law are probably pretty sly, but just asking the question in that open, honest, direct way of the public themselves, I think can be enormously powerful. And, you know, similar initiatives against factory farming have been going on in Switzerland with sentience politics. And so I that's one I really like, because I think it can shift the zeitgeist and the culture, even if it doesn't, you know, necessarily change the law in the following year. But
yeah, absolutely. And I love IP3. I find it so inspiring that, you know, you ask for what we want. And in that framing that, like, these laws already exist, let's just make them stronger. You know, the exact same laws just applying to all animals. I find that really inspiring, and I really hope that it gets on the ballot. I think that would be so powerful. PaxFauna probably will go for initiatives that are trying to find the sweet spot between actually a decent possibility of winning and also telling the story of this societal transformation. So yeah, definitely interested in things like a capo ban or like a ban on like a particular U.S. state or city, like paying for animal products in schools or hospitals today, or even subsidizing, creating some subsidies for alternatives are the types of things that we're interested in right now. But definitely much the policy goal feels almost instrumental towards kind of the goal of cultural change.
Yeah, thank you. Fascinating. Now, the one of the other things you talked about quite a lot is, you know, grassroots and the movement ecosystem and the importance of, I guess, community in this work as well. And I'm interested in, because I see enormous power in that, because it can pull so many levers and it can connect directly with people, and it's just the way stuff gets done. But at the same time, there can sometimes be risks in the way we organize and in the nature of our communities. And it's, again, it may seem a little bit of a stretch, but one of the reasons sometimes I challenge religious organizations is because of the dangerous side effects those communities can sometimes have. And I worry that in some situations, a sort of animal activist mindset risks having some of those red flags too. So one, you have a sort of overarching cause that is super important, and whether it's a religious thing or whether it's, you know, the egregious horror of factory farming, right? There's a really powerful ultimate cause and an end that might justify, you know, some means that others might look at and go, hold on, you've gone off the rails here. There can also be, when you've got a really important cause, group dynamics that can be difficult too. You can end up with very high demand dynamics within a group. You can end up with charismatic leaders. You can end up with high control settings. You can have just, you know, behavioral problems or structural problems that can emerge in a context that, you know, can be like a pressure cooker, right? Because the cause genuinely is deeply, deeply important, and the wrongs being done are egregiously horrific. So in that context, where you could sort of understand how that pressure cooker might, you know, go wrong in a community or a movement sense, how can we keep healthy communities at the grassroots, and how can we watch for those red flags and make sure that we're being compassionate to each other as well as pushing towards a noble end?
Yeah, that's definitely a really big puzzle that's faced by respondents and by social movement organizers everywhere. I think that culture has to be a really huge part of the work. It's not something that's kind of extra to the work of organizing a social movement. It is really, really primary to being able to organize people, is to do really, really intentional cultural interventions to create the kind of culture within movement that we want. A way that we try to contribute to that so far is through providing nonviolent communication training to the movement. And it's an ongoing puzzle. It's definitely a big part of our work to really figure out how we want to influence the culture of the orgs that we hope to launch. I've definitely seen a lot of inter-movement conflict that is really destructive, and I love to think about how much we would really be able to achieve if we could really work together without kind of having as much conflict as we have. I don't think it's specific at all to the animal movement, which itself is sad that that is such a kind of pervasive problem. And I think probably with activism, we attract people who have some pretty intense alienation in the world, and some pretty intense needs that we're trying to get met by like direct communities. I think a really important part of the kind of theory of change is that when we see really big activist change, the way that changes society isn't always through the protests or the open rescue, but about the way that transformed person goes back into their community. And having any kind of group that isolates people from their communities, I think is really counterproductive. Something that we really, really don't want, because the way that we sort of maintain connection is hard, I think, especially for animal rights activists with our families and our, churches and our schools, or people are eating animals there, and it's really uncomfortable for us. And I'm really interested in how we can kind of train people to have maybe a new form of the liberation pledge that is a bit more achievable and doesn't quite isolate ourselves so much.
Yeah.
Some way that we can kind of show up with authenticity, with I'm not pretending that this terrible thing isn't happening, but also some way that I can ask for enough solidarity that I can get it and kind of be able to be there and still remain a part of communities outside of the animal.
Yeah.
I've definitely seen it, seen it happen. We isolate ourselves quite a bit and lose those connections.
Yeah, thank you. It's a tricky challenge, but I mean, I think you're right. Right, if we need to change society, so separating ourselves from it, might feel good in a sense. We can sort of huddle away as our own little in group and criticize everybody else, but it's not going to drive the change we need, is it? Yeah, yeah. And I mean, again, it's the consistency of your nonviolent communication approach, right? In the same way as you could use that to try and engage constructively with the people we're campaigning against, you can also use it to think about how we can constructively work with the people that are supposed to be our allies and we're working with, right? And not let the cause blind us to the fact that we're working with our fellow sentient beings that warrant our compassion and, have all sorts of conflicting interests and needs that we've got to work through together. So, yeah, I guess it applies across the board. Yeah.
Yeah, it applies to ourselves too. We, the advocates, are animals who have needs that be respected, not to be worked with.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's, I tend to be drawn to just sort of consequentialist way of thinking ultimately about ethics, because ultimately what I care about is the experiences of sentient beings. In a sense, they are consequences, right? Human and non-human. So I'm sort of consequentialist in that sense. But I do think the sort of deontological approach of thinking about us being ends and means is a really important check, because it's very easy to, as we've been talking about, think, well, the ends I'm going for are so important that my fellow advocates and even myself, you sort of forget that we warrant compassion for ourselves and each other too. And that can be bad for us, but can also sap our effectiveness, frankly, as we're trying to change society too. So
And from an internal perspective, suffering, I think, can be important. Kind of chosen suffering for the sake of the cause is an important way to kind of make transformation happen.
Yeah.
And I try to think of even kind of the suffering that happens in conflict with our own fellow activists is we kind of endure that and work with it because of the cause, without being maybe self-sacrificing, saying that my experience doesn't matter, but rather my experience does matter so much that I can sort of metabolize suffering into meaning, the way I want to think about it, but it has to sort of be chosen for that to kind of work.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So overall, how does that leave you feeling about our prospects? Because I think if we look back at the history of humanity, I think progress is possible, but we've got a pretty awful track record so far, not just about how we treat each other, but how we treat non-human sentient beings too. How optimistic are you that we could actually sort of shift the role humanity plays with regard to sentient kind going forward, which of those frames feels more, you know, compelling or likely to you?
Yeah, it's definitely a tough question. It's really hard to be optimistic depending on where you look. And I do think we have a lot of potential. I think the grassroots in the U.S. can achieve a lot. I think we've seen kind of a groundswell of interest a lot of times in the past with kind of at the height of the idea, of save really a lot of people. And I don't think it's for lack of people. I think it was a really strategic orientation we can make change happen. Probably not going to be the change that I want to see to the extent that I would like to see in my lifetime. And it's feels very worth putting a lifetime into.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's inspiring. And I share that sense. It does feel like things are shifting. I mean, obviously it's a very different picture in different parts of the world, but it does feel like things are shifting. And looking back, you can be surprised at how quickly change can happen when it gets to that sort of tipping point. So let's see if we can get there. Yeah. So that's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking through your sort of philosophical journey and your thoughts about how to make a better future too. What's the best way of people following you, supporting your work at Pax Fauna, staying up to date with your court cases that comes through, of course, and supporting you there?
So paxfauna.org is where we put all of our blogs. We put out a lot of blogs on different topics, a lot of kind of overlap with what we've talked about today. We have a mailing list there. We also usually post those on Instagram, paxfauna. My Instagram is my name, Eva Hamer. And we have also volunteer opportunities and kind of recruiting. So if anyone who's interested can reach out about those. Thank you so much for having me. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Thank you. Well, I will let you get on with the rest of your day. Thank you again for taking the time to talk to me and be a guest on Sentientist Conversations. Please stay in touch.
So much as well.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?